I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Yesterday, Baltimore City and the Department of Justice signed an agreement to reform the Baltimore Police Department. We begin today with WIPR Metro reporter Kenneth Burns on the consent decree, what it says and what it may mean going forward. Then it's the latest installment of What You Got Cookin'. We'll dive into the cuisine of the Chesapeake Bay with Chef John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant at the BMA and Kathy and Neil Patterson, authors of a new book, Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. What are your favorite seafood recipes and what food traditions do you have that draw inspiration from the Chesapeake? We'll take your calls, emails, and tweets. Crabs, oysters, mussels, and more. The Bounty of the Bay on Midday, right after the news. And welcome to the program, everybody. I am Tom Hall. This is Midday. We're going to talk about Chesapeake cuisine a little bit later. There's a terrific new book called Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. We have the authors of that book with us, along with our good friend John Shields from Gertrude's at the BMA. But before we get to Chesapeake cuisine, I want to talk a little bit to WIPR Metro reporter Kenneth Burns, who has been covering this big story that broke yesterday, the consent decree that was signed between the Department of Justice and the City of Baltimore, aiming to reform the Baltimore City Police Department. Kenny, good to see you.
Good afternoon.
So what's in this consent decree? What does it say the police have to do?
Well, they have to do a lot. They are required to record information at each police stop of location, race, ethnicity, age, all the demographic questions, as I like to call them.
That represents a considerable increase in paperwork that they have to do that they have not heretofore been doing.
Yes, and it should be interesting to note that unlike other jurisdictions in Maryland, or most jurisdictions in Maryland, there are no computers in the squad cars of the Baltimore Police Department. Officers have to.
So for the moment, they're going to be writing this stuff out by hand.
Right. Officers have to introduce themselves by name and rank. There will be a task force, a civilian task force, to oversee how more civilian oversight could be taken care of. A better effort to coordinate with city schools. They have their own police department. Improved training for sexual assault detectives. That was a lot discussed in the original report that came out over the summer. That was quite scathing against the police department. Officers who carry a firearm, they have to have one less lethal weapon with them as well. All vans and cruisers have to have functioning seatbelts, and they have to have cameras in the transport wagons. That was an issue that came up during the Freddie Gray case trial last year. And there have to be easier methods to file complaints, including a 24-hour hotline, among several other areas.
Yeah, so this really is sweeping. I mean, and it really became when this report was issued by the Department of Justice in August, it was amazing. It was like the word scathing was intractably attached to the DOJ report. You never heard about the DOJ report. You heard about the scathing DOJ report. Does this appear to, and obviously it's a 227-page document. I'm not sure you've had a chance to read every paragraph, but does it appear to address all of the concerns that were raised in the DOJ report last summer?
It appears so. There was a lot in that report, including some stories from people that the Justice Department discussed with, which is why one of the recommendations is training on how to interact with young people. That's also a part of this consent decree. And it also talks about what officers can't do. They can't use chokeholds or neck holds unless deadly force is authorized. And if there's no other alternative, you just can't stop anybody anymore if you just think they're up to no good. So there's a lot of restrictions for some officers that have been used as far as past police practices for the city police department, but there's also a lot of guiding. And then also keep in mind, and Commissioner Kevin Davis pointed this out, they kind of got ahead of the game with the body cameras, a whole department to interact with the Justice Department. And last week he announced police officers have to undergo several more hours of training, in the neighborhood of 80 hours of training per year.
And when Mayor Catherine Pugh was asked about this yesterday at the press conference, when she basically summed up what the gist of the matter is with this consent decree. It's training, 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 training.
Right. And she also is supporting this document. She says best represents the city. If it didn't, she wouldn't have been standing at that podium.
How much is it going to cost? Do we know?
It's going to cost big, millions and millions of dollars. We don't have, or at least I haven't seen, the final price tag on all of this.
You were at the press conference yesterday. I talked to Mary Rose Madden earlier this morning from the WYPR news team, who was also at the press conference. Mary Rose seemed to think that the mayor didn't appear to be all that concerned about finding the money to pay for this.
She didn't, and she made it clear cost was no object because she wanted a constitutional police department. She's already started to reach out to the Maryland delegation to Washington, Senator Chris Van Hollen, Ben Cardin, as well as Elijah Cummings, the congressman who was also at the press conference as well.
And Governor Hogan has indicated a willingness to at least look for some funds from the state to help subsidize it.
Absolutely. Keep in mind, the Baltimore City Police Department is a state agency. So, of course, the governor's going to have some skin in that game.
A judge has been appointed to oversee the consent decree, Judge Bedar. People have taken note of the fact that he's a rare appointment who served as a public defender in the federal prosecutor's office, or the federal office of justice, whatever they call it. What do we know about Judge Bedar?
Well, he's really a judge that's been on both sides. He's been a federal defender. In fact, that's what brought him to Maryland. But when in Colorado, his native Colorado, he was also a prosecutor locally. So, and plus, from all accounts, he seems like, or at least he's been described as, a fair jurist.
I understand that the first step is that Judge Bedar has to approve the consent decree. Is there a chance that the judge is going to say, nope, this isn't good enough?
There's a possibility. A judge has been known to change consent decrees or redline some items. But even before that, both the city and the Justice Department asked Judge Bedar to hold a public hearing and allow the public to put some input on this consent decree before everything's final.
Speaking of input, representatives of the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, made it a point to say that they were not invited to the table. They had no input in this consent decree. Obviously, the top brass of the police department, Commissioner Davis and others, were part of this negotiation to come up with this consent decree. But what's the reaction of the FOP been?
There hasn't been a new reaction, but even still, that raises a couple of questions. And that's one of the first things I'm going to do rather quickly. Look at the extent of the police union, whether it's a benevolent association or a fraternal order of police. How involved have they been in a negotiation of a consent decree? From my best guess is they probably talked with the Justice Department while they were doing the investigation and forming their report from last year. But as far as what the Justice Department told the FOP, as far as how the extent of their involvement with the negotiations, that wasn't mentioned at all. They just said that everyone participated as far as doing input, giving input into the Justice Department report.
One of the issues here that Mary Rose Madden and others have brought up is the fact that in the old way of doing things on the street with the rank and file of the police, their metrics and their performance was gauged on, you know, number of stops, number of arrests, number of citations issued. If they're going to go away from that, if they're going to move away from that into a more community policing engagement style, what do you have any sense of what the new metrics are going to be? How are cops going to be judged by their superiors as to whether they're doing a good job?
For Baltimore, this is truly uncharted territory, and the report pointed this out last summer. A lot of the current leadership is still a remnant from that time of zero tolerance policing and stat-driven policing where you make those arrests and make those stops. So as far as how it will look for Baltimore, that's a good question. Other police departments, they've been able to give a model of what community policing looks like and how de-escalation tactics work. In fact, This American Life last year, they followed North Las Vegas Police Department to kind of show what that looked like as far as changing how policing is done in that city.
Department of Justice is currently monitoring 20 such consent decrees, as according to Loretta Lynch, who was at the press conference yesterday with the mayor and State's Attorney Mosby and others.
They just added Chicago, so it's going to be more. We could start, I guess, officially saying more than 21.
Yeah, yeah. And Chicago, another scathing report, as it were, and they've got problems that are certainly on par, if not even worse, than Baltimore. Loretta Lynch has a week left in office. Her term ends, on the 20th of January at noon, along with everybody else's in the outgoing Obama administration. What are the chances that a new administration, the Trump administration, putatively Jeff Sessions from Alabama, will become the new attorney general? What are the chances that this will be enforced, that the consent decree will stay in force and that it will be paid attention to by the new administration?
Well, it appears Baltimore is safe because all the papers have been filed, the consent decree has been filed, as well as all the other documents. This will probably affect Chicago more than anything else because, keep in mind, it was about 5 or 6 months before we received our consent decree. Chicago, they've just received their report from the Justice Department. They're not going to have an agreement ironed out in a week. So it'll be real interesting to see how much effect the new administration will have on Chicago more than it will Baltimore. Because as far as Baltimore is concerned, it looks like most of the work is done.
Right. And the mayor did make a concerted effort to get it done before the Obama administration left office.
Right. And the pick of Jeff Sessions for attorney general, that has a lot of concern for everybody in terms of particularly police reform, not just here, but across the country.
Well, Kenny Burns, I appreciate it. I know you're going to be staying on top of this, as will we here at Midday. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thank you for having me.
Let me tell you about one other thing before we take a break. There's a play that's being presented a week from tomorrow at Coppin State. This is the 21st. It's going to take place at 7:30 at night in the James Weldon Johnson Auditorium over at Coppin State. It's put on by a group based in Brooklyn. It's a social justice theater group called Outside the Wire. It will include the actor Paul Giamatti, who's in John Adams, and he's in that show Billions, which I think is an Amazon thing. Sonia Sohn, who many remember from The Wire. Dwayne Foster from Ragtime. And Marjolaine Goldsmith, who's in Compromise. It's called Antigone in Ferguson, and it's about the relationship between the community and the police. So they're going to do a dramatic reading of this ancient Greek play written by Sophocles, and it's about what happens when there's a clash between state law and personal conviction, and violence ensued, as it did here in Baltimore. It will be performed in addition by a gospel choir made up of members of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Choir, as well as officers in the Baltimore Police Department and activists from both Ferguson and Baltimore. So Antigone and Ferguson, a really interesting theatrical occasion that will be followed by a community conversation about this very difficult and complicated issue of the relationship between the Baltimore City Police Department and the community. So that's going to happen again Saturday the 21st at 7:30 at night at Coppin State University. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. When we come back, we're going to talk about Maryland's Chesapeake, how the bay and its bounty shaped a cuisine. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall with your favorite Chesapeake Bay-inspired recipes and food traditions. We look forward to hearing from you and to talking to Kathy and Neil Patterson about their terrific new book. It's Midday. Stay with us.
Something up with me.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's time now for another installment of What You Got Cookin', where we talk about recipes and food trends and traditions and good eats in general. Today, we're going to focus on Chesapeake cuisine with one of our resident foodies, John Shields. He's a chef, an author, and the owner, along with John Gilligan, of Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He's also the host of Coastal Cooking and Chesapeake Bay Cooking on Maryland Public Television and PBS. John, Happy New Year. Good to see you.
Happy New Year, Tom.
And also joining us today is the Baltimore dining duo, Kathy and Neil Patterson. They are the authors of Food Lover's Guide to Baltimore, and their latest book is a beauty. It's called Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. Welcome to you both. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to meet you, too.
You are welcome to join our conversation with your favorite recipes that are inspired by things you can get at the Bay, both in the water and on terra firma on the eastern and western shore. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Midday@WIPR.org is the email address and our Twitter handle if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Kathy, how did you two become the Baltimore dining duo?
Well, we started doing a column for a local neighborhood magazine in Towson, and it just seemed weird just to have just our individual name, so I thought it'd be nice if we had something that was a little bit more catchy, so we came up with the Baltimore Dining Duo.
And Neil, you've written about subjects other than cooking as well, right?
Yes. I've done fiction writing. I have a book of short stories, and I also just recently had a piece that appears on the National Postal Museum about Native American representation in post office murals that were painted during the New Era period.
Fun. So you investigated all sorts of stuff. What's interesting is that it's kind of difficult, Kathy, to even define what folks refer to as Chesapeake cuisine, isn't it? What do you think that entails?
It was kind of difficult to decide exactly what to talk about in this book, but we already had some sort of idea being lifelong Marylanders, so we knew we had to talk about the seafood that we eat all the time, the crabs and things like that. But there was some conversation on whether we should include the fauna from the land, like we eat venison in Maryland. Should we talk about venison? Should we talk about wild boar? There's lots of wild boar in the area. And should we discuss that, or should we keep it to seafood and vegetables? But then we decided that chicken was such a huge cash crop, as it were, in Maryland, that we needed to include that too, especially since most of the chicken farms, or all the chicken farms, are on the eastern shore.
Right
up against the Chesapeake.
Right. So you talk about crabs and oysters and the fish from the sea, but also about strawberries and silver queen corn and chicken recipes and tomatoes. We can't forget tomatoes. And John Shields, you've written a ton of books on this very subject. You got, what, four of them out,
yeah,
or something like that?
Something like that.
With another on the way, yeah. In a year from now or so. Is there anything that strikes you as, or the one thing that strikes you as, particular, interesting, unique, distinctive about Chesapeake cuisine as opposed to the cuisines of other places?
Well, one of the things when I was doing research originally for the first book, I ran across something that Captain John Smith had written in his diary. And he said that when they first sailed into the Chesapeake, that the fish were so thick, we attempted to catch them with frying pans. So for me, that kind of defined what Chesapeake Bay cooking is about, not specifically about the fish, but about the technique, taking the freshest, the best that we have all over this huge territory of the Chesapeake, and treating it simply with a lot of respect and letting those flavors shine through. So, if you look at most Chesapeake recipes, from a historical context, or even a lot of things that we're seeing right now or in the books, they're relatively simple. They're relatively things that you already have in your pantry. You don't have to go out looking for a bazillion new things. It's food, and it's real, and it's right around us, and is where it swims and where it grows.
Yeah, so here in Maryland, it's certainly accessible in the farmers markets, both on the Eastern Shore and even here in Central Maryland. Neil, what strikes me, you start with the history of the Chesapeake Bay, even alluding to the Ice Age. You go way back in this book. and I was struck that you remind us that it's about 195 miles
that encompasses what we know as the Bay. That's a lot of area. I mean, that's like the distance from where we're sitting to Times Square. I mean, it's big.
It's big. It's very big. Yes, it's an estuary that is coming off the Susquehanna River, and there's other rivers that feed into it. And it pretty much separates Maryland right down the middle. I mean, we have the eastern shore, the western shore, and it's brought a whole kind of culture to both sides of Maryland. The eastern shore developed more of a farming community, and the western shore was more shipping and industrial because they had access to the west once the railroads came in. So there was it really kind of defines what Maryland is in a way, and how we function in Maryland.
Neil Patterson's here with us in Studio A, along with his wife, Kathy Patterson. Their new book's called Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. And we're joined by John Shields, one of our resident foodies here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number to join the conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Kathy, you mentioned that there are estimates of about 100,000 slaves being brought to Maryland between the late 17th century and the late 18th century. But you mentioned that there's actually very little African-American or African influence on the cuisine of the Chesapeake Bay and the eastern and western shore. Why do you think that is?
Well, because most of the slaves were not allowed to cook their own food. The food was supplied to them by the plantation owners. Unlike farther in the South, they were growing their own crops and raising their own animals, and they were, you know, feeding themselves. So they were able to incorporate more of the African traditional foods in what they did. But in Maryland, they kind of had to eat what everybody else ate.
There is a huge influence, however, from the Native American community who was here when the first settlers came over. How does that get evidenced? Where do we see that come through?
Well, they basically taught us how to eat. When the first colonists came over, they were looking for fortune. They weren't looking to colonize. And so it was a bunch of rich guys, and they didn't know how to cook for themselves or take care of themselves, and they brought wheat that didn't grow. And so the Native Americans had to teach them how to plant corn and use corn and save corn for, you know, don't eat it all now, save some for later. So they had a very strong influence there. Then also, you know, the Native Americans had been eating the oysters and the crabs, and of course they had those in Europe too. But there were new techniques with the food, and you know, they were teaching them things they didn't already know.
Neil, you mentioned that there are as many as 300 species of fish in the bay. I mean, it's enormous. There's a lot.
Yes, there is. Not all of it is predominantly eaten. You know, we primarily
some of it's the big fish are eating the little fish,
exactly,
and we don't eat the little ones.
Right.
Yeah,
there's a whole feeding chain there, and so it's primarily the larger fish that we're eating. But yes, it's a vast, very delicate ecosystem, and unfortunately, because of what we can exploit from the bay, we've kind of thrown that balance off, and it's not a recent thing. I mean, it started from the time that even with the Native Americans coming here, they excessively were eating oysters and crabs and things, and so it's really started way back when, and so we're still struggling with keeping that balance.
Neil Patterson and Kathy Patterson, we're talking about their new book, Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Howard in Towson, welcome to Midday. We're talking about Chesapeake cuisine. What's your question today?
Hi. In the introduction to the program, you mentioned Chesapeake Bay and mussels. My understanding is the bay mussels are ribbed mussels that grow on the marsh. We've eaten them and found them to have no flavor. So I'm wondering how your restaurants serve the Chesapeake Bay mussels.
All right, John, do you guys serve Chesapeake Bay mussels at Gertrude's?
No, there's no mussel industry in the bay. There's some invasive mussel that like a zebra mussel that's over here, but we don't use any of them culinarily. Everything comes from, you know, up north in the colder waters, and, you know, we use the black mussels.
Yeah, but there's plenty to fish for around here, though. I mean, in terms of fish and crab and oysters and stuff. We'll talk about some stuff with oysters in just a second. Aaron in Baltimore, you got a question about something called Maryland stuffed ham. That's a new one to me. I never heard that one.
I do. A few years ago, I took a trip down to St. Mary's to attend the Oyster Festival there, and was surprised to see that as many different plates of oysters as they had, there were as many plates of Maryland stuffed ham in sandwiches. And it was a boiled ham stuffed with spicy greens and then served cold and sliced. I have been living in the Baltimore area for many years and had never heard of this dish anywhere outside of St. Mary's or outside of the state for that matter. So I was hoping that your guests could maybe speak to the origin of this really interesting Maryland food.
Interesting. Have you guys, Kathy, Neil, ever heard of this? I don't remember reading about it in your book.
No, when we were originally considering talking about other animals besides chickens and fish and crabs, was toying with the idea of including a recipe for the stuffed ham, and did some research on it and found that it probably has roots from a dish, and I can't remember exactly now what region it was in the U.K., but it's like Lancashire. It's just a small area. Then they made something that was very, very similar. They took a ham, they stuffed it with greens. They didn't season it as much as we do here, because we use cayenne pepper, and you know, it was spicy here. But that's probably where it came from. There might have been some settlers from that particular region, and they brought it to Maryland.
Aaron, are you still with us?
I am.
What did they stuff it with? Do you know exactly what was in there?
I do, yeah. I asked quite a few vendors during the Oyster Festival, and they told me that it was a mix of different greens, mustard greens, kale, and maybe some turnip greens that they boiled down with pepper, spices, and onions, and then cut slits into the ham all around, and then stuffed the spicy greens into the slits, and then put the entire whole ham into a cheesecloth, and then boiled it in water for several hours, and then cooled it and sliced it.
Huh. Interesting. John Shields, I mean, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, very, very much so. It's a huge, well-known dish all over Southern Maryland, and I was fortunate enough to make it with this guy, William Taylor, from Satterley Plantation on my television show. And it's quite the process. It's something you want to do with a family. You're getting a tremendous amount of greens, all kinds, you know, like they said, kale, collards, chopping them all up, chopping onions up. Has lots of red pepper, mustard seed in it, and you have to stuff it. Now, it's not a regular ham. It's not a ham as we think of ham. It's ham simply means the cut of the meat. It's the hind, you know, the leg. And so it's a corned ham, which is like if you're doing a corned beef. Mm-hmm. So it's a fresh ham. You corn it, you bone it, and then it's tied. And then you're taking that and you're stuffing that with all the greens. And before you, when you do the cheesecloth deal, you know, you put the rest of the greens that are left over on the bottom, put the ham that's stuffed on top of that, and then more greens on top of that, and then you tie the whole thing up, preferably with fishing line, and you put it in the big pot and you cook it. But it's a big deal.
That is a big deal. That is a big deal. Well, all I know is that our producer, Bridget Armstrong, and our director and engineer, Luke Spicknall, they refer to me as a stuffed ham, because they consider me basically a recipe for disaster. But that's a different thing. So that's the only stuffed ham I'm familiar with. It's just when I look in the mirror. I want to talk about oysters. Kathy, you break a myth about pearls coming from oysters in your book. This is breaking news. Perhaps hearing it here first on Midday.
A lot of people think that your regular oyster, when you crack it open, you're going to slurp down the oyster, you might find a pearl. Well, you might find this little thing in there, but it's not very valuable at all. It's like as valuable as a kidney stone because it's just secretions by the oyster. But the pearls that are valuable are coated with a, for lack of a better term, pearlescent substance called nacre. And that's what is so shiny and has a little bit of a rainbow quality to it. And there's only specific creatures that do that. And they're more closely related to mussels than to oysters.
Interesting. So, Neil, what's the best time of year to buy oysters? Is there a time of year that you capitalize?
Am I going to get this straight? It's years. It's the months without R's in them, right?
One is for crabs and one's for oysters. What is it? Can we remember?
It's the other way around.
Don't whisper. Don't whisper, Kathy. Tell us. Give us the answer if Neil's shaky out, if you know.
These days, you can buy oysters safely and enjoy them all year long because we have farmed oysters. And farmed oysters do not spawn. And that's the problem with it. The wisdom was that you don't eat oysters in months that don't have an R in them because they were going to spawn. And so they were spending all of their energy for making, you know, all the good stuff to be spawning. And so the flesh was a little watery and not very interesting. But farmed oysters tend not to spawn. It's a different kind of oyster. It's a triploid, so they are sterile. And so you can eat them all year round, and they're delicious.
So farmed oysters, no problem to eat. And actually, the oyster canning industry began in the Chesapeake Bay, did it not?
It did. I mean,
they figured out how to put them in cans and ship them out across the country.
Yeah, it was a huge industry. I mean, well, there were mountains of oyster reefs all up and down the bay, so it was kind of hard to circumnavigate in those days. And most of the thing about the months with the letter R, it was a myth kind of that came from the fishermen from Europe, because in Europe they had a red tide every year in the warmer months, and people just died. So they didn't like that and made them nervous.
Yeah, you hate
so
when that
So when they came over here, they put that same thing into place, but it's not the same thing. And so, but it did make most sense because the oysters are skinnier. They're not quite as nice in the summer because of the spawning. And also refrigeration. We didn't have refrigeration until just recently. So, that had a lot to do with it.
So before we take a break, we have a tweet here from Stephanie, who's obsessed with something that I can't pronounce. It's spelled H-Y-G-G-E. Does that ring a bell to you guys? Higgy? Higgy? I'm obsessed with whatever this is. H-Y-G-G-E. Thanks for talking about it. So we'll look it up and we'll have an answer for you after the break. We're going to take a little bit of break. And when we come back, more on Chesapeake Cooking, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @midday, Tom Hall. The book is called Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. We're here with Kathy and Neil Patterson, along with John Shields from Gertrude's Restaurant. It's What You Got Cooking on Midday. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to Midday with Tom Hall on your public radio. This is member-supported 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday, and it's What You Got Cooking here on our program. We're talking about Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine, a beautiful new book and cookbook written by Kathy and Neil Patterson, who joined me here in the studio along with John Shields from Gertrude's at the BMA. By the way, coming up on the program next week, we'll take a look back at President Obama's 8 years in the White House. On Monday, Martin Luther King Day, Dr. Sherry Parks will stop by to talk about the president as an orator. We'll discuss his most poignant speeches, and we'll talk about whether or not his comments moved the dial on issues like policing and race and gun control. We'll also take a look at First Lady Michelle Obama's 8 years in the White House. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist E.R. Shipp will join us as well on Monday. And then later in the week, we'll talk with Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated, the historian Taylor Branch, the author and political commentator Michael Eric Dyson, and Michael Days, an editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer, who's written a book about the legacy of Barack Obama. That's all coming up next week here on Midday. And, of course, NPR will bring you complete live coverage of the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump on Friday the 20th. If you're just joining us today, we're having a delicious conversation about the Bounty of the Bay with Kathy and Neil Patterson about their new book, Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. Resident foodie John Shields is also here. He's a chef and author and owner of Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He's also the host of Coastal Cooking and Chesapeake Bay Cooking on Maryland Public Television. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So I think we have figured out what Stephanie tweeted. They don't have U's and umlauts on Twitter, I guess. So she was referring to hygge, which was the subject of On Point with Tom Ashbrook the hour before we came on the air. So there's two Toms. There's Tom Ashbrook, and I'm Tom Hall. You can always tell us apart. Tom Ashbrook is smarter and much better looking. But they were talking about hygge, which I guess is like Danish comfort something. I wasn't able to listen to that whole program.
It's all the rage. I mean, it's all the rage. It's going to be here in the United States anytime. And it's about the whole sense of well-being, of comfort, of the sense of warmth. So I guess we can do it with what? Some fried oysters, candlelight, and a fire. And you got
there. You go,
Jesse Hygge.
It takes you right, Jesse Hygge.
There you go.
A little taste of Denmark right here in Balmer. Very good. All right, Tom sends us an email or a Twitter a tweet rather that says that his favorite is to stock up on fall rockfish and make fish cakes to last me all winter. That seems like a good idea, Kathy.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, you can make fish cakes, I guess, with a whole bunch of different kinds of fish, right?
You can. Whatever fish you can find, which you prefer. And, I mean, a fish cake, you know, you need a binder. Like a crab cake, you need a binder and flaked fish, and you season it, and, yeah, fry them up. They'd be delicious.
Yeah, you're ready to rock and roll. Carlisle in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with John Shields and Kathy and Neil Patterson.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, there's so many things I could say. First off, in terms of the rockfish, I think we have one of the best fish in the world. It's so, so wonderful to eat, and I will try that rockfish recipe. I have Mr. DeShields, several of his cookbooks, so I'm excited about that, too. And lastly, I want to say that I did a talk two Christmases ago at Orianda House in Leakin Park about the history of the oyster in the Chesapeake Bay, and particularly about Baltimore. And if you go to SoundCloud and then go to Crossing the Chesapeake, that's my channel, you'll hear a talk that I gave. And there were wars, literally, in the 1870s, 1880s, there were wars where people wanted to get in on the whole way of becoming a millionaire doing oystering. And so they would come down from the north because their oysters beds had dried up, and they would come south to us. And I mean, I could go on and on and on, and I won't. But the whole oyster war thing is totally fascinating, to the point that in the 1950s there was still a treaty between the states of Maryland and Virginia over the line, How can you cross that line?
With the oysters. Do you have a particular favorite way to prepare oysters? How do you like to make them?
I don't. I'm still searching. I think the Thames Street Oyster Bar, or Thames Street, however you want to say that, is phenomenal with their cuisine. So I'm looking for oyster stew recipes. And that's all pretty fascinating, too, because oysters, we look at them as really an expensive thing, but at the time, they were a cheap commodity, and people would be buying them off of the street. If you go, well, there are just so many things that
Well,
we
thanks
could
for the call,
about.
Carla. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. So, oyster stew recipe, Kathy, what do you think?
Well, there's oyster stew recipe in Maryland's Chesapeake, and there's also a kind of a riff on it. It's a oyster and bacon pot pie, so it has kind of like a stew-like insides with a nice crispy topping on it. I mean, oyster stew is great, and it's really good comfort food, too.
Last time you were here, John, you left the studio and went to judge The Oyster Festival. Was that the one in St. Mary's?
In St. Mary's County.
Yeah.
That was wild.
Yeah.
It always is. I love it. It's.
I mean, what has popped out of you over the years about the unique ways people prepare oysters?
Well, you know, it's really changed a good bit. When I was going down there 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know, it was a bit more traditional, more kind of old English style of cooking. But now they're going all over the place. You know, you're seeing Asian influence, Caribbean influences, all kinds of things. But the one thing that is so important whenever they do it, the oyster has to be the star. So for the judges, if whatever technique they use overpowers the oyster, they lose so many points. But this year, I believe it was a Asian-influenced one, and it was just beautiful.
Yeah, but it just shows that there's a bazillion different ways of preparing them.
Yeah,
right?
There are. And,
So if there were wars about oysters back in the day, I think the wars now are about who makes the best crab cake, you know, and I think every restaurant in the state of Maryland claims to have the best crab cake.
Yeah.
I know you do have a really good crab cake at Gertrude's, and, you know, but there are other places that, claim as such. Of course, Maryland is known for blue crabs, right? What are your favorite ways to prepare crabs in general, and is there a particular secret, do you think, Neil, to the perfect crab cake?
Perfect crab cake. Well, that's a real, you know, you can get into some fights over that. I think it depends on what people prefer. I prefer a more moist crab cake, something that would sort of border on like crab imperial, you know, something that's very kind of loose. But people like something that's maybe with more binder and tighter. I think it's really something that you can fight. I mean, some people like to put a lot of seasoning. I think you need to be a little more gentle with it because crab has a nice, sweet, delicate flavor, and you don't want to overpower
that.
Yeah,
again, you just don't want to overdo it. Yeah.
Right.
You have a great recipe in here, Kathy, for a tomato gazpacho with a lump of crab in the middle of it. I think that looks really delicious. A friend of mine, Gwen Davidson, made this summer. She has a house in Virginia on the Rappahannock River, and so she had some fresh crab that she put over a watermelon gazpacho. It was terrific. I mean, so crab goes with a whole bunch of other dishes as well.
Oh, definitely. For people who want a crab soup but they don't feel like making a hot crab soup, I mean, if it's a really, really hot day and they can just throw some things in a blender, some tomatoes, some peppers, cucumber, make a traditional gazpacho and just take your crab meat, which fortunately is already cooked, don't have to cook that extra, put a light vinaigrette on it, some corn, some seasoning, and plop it on your salad, and it's a beautiful summertime dish. But you could eat it any time of year too if you get a hankering for a gazpacho.
Yeah. I mean, John, there is no one, you know, singular only way everybody does Maryland crab soup, right? I mean, crab soup in Maryland is a gazillion ways.
It's all over the place. I mean, and you have the main things that you're going to find is the red crab soup, which we call the vegetable crab soup or a Maryland crab soup, and the cream of crab soup. And so that's where, you know, people get into, you know, the kind that they like best. There's actually in this book, the Maryland's Chesapeake, have one with hominy in one of the soups. That sounds really nice.
You fill pozole. It out a little bit.
Pozole.
It's a pozole recipe. Yeah. With the but it's a green pozole, and because hominy was a Maryland product, and we had hominy canning plants all over Baltimore. People don't even really think of that as being something local, and I don't think a lot of people eat that anymore. So I thought I wanted to include that because it was a corn product, and a pozole is like a Mexican style soup. It's a lot of times it's got a red base to it with tomatoes, but with tomatillos it's a little bit lighter, and it really works with crab.
Yeah, my wife Linnell is a big fan of hominy.
I love hominy.
And she grew up eating hominy on Thanksgiving and Christmas. It was part of their holiday meals. And so when we do Thanksgiving or Christmas at our house, we have hominy, which is always fun. Besides the blue crab in Maryland, what other kinds of crabs are there?
Blue crabs are what we have in Maryland.
Oh, so
except in the grocery store, well, you'll find Thai crab, you'll find Portunus pelagicus, but crab containers should be labeled so you know what you're getting. Mm-hmm. If it costs $10 a pound, it is not Maryland crab meat.
Mm-hmm.
And not that there's anything wrong with not being able to afford Maryland crab meat, because some people can't. But it just doesn't have the same rich, buttery, sweet, fatty flavor that Maryland crab meat has.
You also have a how-to guide to do the crabs with the mallets, right? I mean,
right.
When you're having a crab feast, you've got a how-to guide about how, for newbies to Maryland who haven't been to a crab feast before. Otherwise, you know, these poor people would end up 3 hours later starving to death.
Right. Well, we've encountered this firsthand, and we talked about this in the introduction, that people who come to Maryland from outside the state just really don't understand the concept of dumping a big pile of blue crabs on the table and just ripping into them. And there is a certain technique, and some people have some variations, but we do give a step-by-step instruction on how to, you know, break off the claws and break into the claw meat and then, you know, get into the main body. So hopefully they can have a little better time and not kind of stare at everybody else in bewilderment about how to deal with it.
First time when I first moved here back in 1982, it was in the summers in July, and we were invited, my girlfriend and I were invited to a crab feast, and we went, and there's this, you know, on the picnic table, this gigantic thing of crabs, and like 4 hours later, we had gotten, you know, an ounce of food. We actually stopped at McDonald's on the way home. And that may be the last time I ever went to a McDonald's, but we were just starving because we didn't know how to do it. And people were very nice about it. They kept trying to show us and trying to do. For some reason, I can do a lobster without any trouble, but a Maryland crab just, you know, flummoxes me. It's difficult. Let's talk about some of the species of fish that are living in the Chesapeake Bay. We mentioned that there's more than 300 of them. Kathy, can you tell me what a lake trout is? You see these lake trout places all the time. I've never had one, but people use that term. What does that mean?
Well, it's not a trout, and it doesn't come from a lake.
Other than that, it's perfectly named.
Exactly. It was probably originally at markets where they would have fish coming in at the end of the day, and people were probably saying, late trout, and it was misheard as lake trout. That's probably where it got the name. But it's a couple of random species of fish that have a certain shape and size, and they're you know, fished out in the Atlantic, and you know, they're frozen on the boat and brought ashore. I mean, they're definitely not from a lake, and people love them fried up, bones and all, slapped between two pieces of bread, and it's very popular.
It can be. It certainly is popular. John, what's your take on farm raised fish? Because there's so much of it now in the grocery stores. I mean, and, you know, you have the option to buy this stuff. If it's not fresh and it is farm-raised, I mean, what do you think?
Well, you know, that's kind of all over the place because there's different types of fish that are farmed. For instance, wild Atlantic salmon. Most of the thought process on this is not such a good thing. You know, it's penned. There's a tremendous amount of antibiotics that are going in there. There are fears of the farmed, you know, modified fish getting loose into the general population. But then you have other industries like the catfish that's done in the USA that is a much more sustainable product. It's a much more healthy product. So, you know, it depends on the thing. The shrimp industry in Southeast Asia, not so good. You might not want to get things there. So you really need to do a little bit of research on that. The number one farm-raised fish in the United States is catfish. But we here in the Chesapeake, we don't need to worry about that because we have the blue catfish, the blue channel catfish, and we have more catfish than Carter's got liver pills. In fact, it's taken up about 80% of the biomass of the rivers in the southern part of the bay.
All right, so no shortage of that.
So we need to eat that, and it is delicious.
John Shields is a chef, an author, and the owner, along with John Gilligan, of Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He's also the host of Coastal Cooking and Chesapeake Bay Cooking on Maryland Public Television and PBS. Kathy and Neil Patterson are a Baltimore dining duo and the authors of A Food Lover's Guide to Baltimore and their latest book, which is called Maryland's Chesapeake, How the Bay and Its Bounty Shaped a Cuisine. Thanks to all of you. Appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
We'll have links and some of the recipes that we talked about today on our website, wypr.org/ Midday. That's it for us today. Coming up next week, a series of conversations about the legacy of Barack Obama. On Monday, we'll talk about First Lady Michelle Obama's impact in the White House with University of Maryland professor Sherry Parks and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist E.R. Shipp. And we'll take a look at some of President Obama's most memorable speeches and addresses. Midday is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coglin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Charlie Hines and Xandra Ellen provide production assistance. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls and tweets and emails. And thanks for subscribing to the Midday podcast. I look forward to being with you next week. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.